Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to check in with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. In the studio with me today, Katie Belfast. Katie currently serves as the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Also with us in Milwaukee right now, Ken Leinbach. Ken is the nationally recognized educator and leader in community-based environmental education, currently serves as the executive director of the Urban Ecology Center. So we'll talk about wetlands and their upcoming conference today, and I hope you'll join in the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or post your questions and comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kent Leinbach, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Katie Belfast, always great to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having us. Thank you.
I always ask you this, and I think it's worth asking every time you're on. Tell us about the Wisconsin Wetlands Association.
Our organization is in its 49th year this year. We'll be celebrating our 50th anniversary next year, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. And we're a statewide organization working for the protection, restoration, and enjoyment of wetlands and related ecosystems. We do policy outreach, education. We work with private landowners and local communities. Basically, we help people and communities care for wetlands. We also, as you pointed out in the intro, we host an annual Wetland Science Conference that helps to share information amongst and between the wetland professionals and enthusiasts in our state, where folks can present the latest research and management techniques, and we can hear some really great stuff going on for wetlands.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that as we move along today. I want to get to Ken for just a minute to talk about the Urban Ecology Center. What's up with that center? Tell us about it.
Well, sure. We're a community center in Milwaukee, and we have three vibrant centers that are serving the Central City schools and the neighborhoods and communities around those schools with quality environmental education and a way for the community to connect with each other. And I'll be speaking at the Wetlands Conference coming up February 21st and working with Katie on that.
No, that's wonderful. And that conference, actually, it runs from the 20th through the 22nd, isn't
it? Yep, it's 2.5 days. We're in Lake Geneva this year. We have a couple of events everybody's welcome to attend the conference, of course, but we also have a couple of events built in, including Ken's talk, that we'd welcome anyone from the public who's interested to attend.
And you had to change the location. If somebody had it written in a long time back, there's a different location here.
Yeah, originally we were published to have our conference in Oconomowoc. And, every year I have nightmares organizing a big conference for 400 people and things that might happen. And it actually happened this year that our venue is closing its doors and we had to move the whole conference. But it's working out great, and the Grand Geneva and Lake Geneva will be a wonderful place for us to have the conference.
And you had 3 whole weeks to make that.
That's right. Yeah, plenty of time.
Plenty of time. So what's the theme of the conference?
Our conference theme this year is wetland resilience. We're really looking at ways that wetlands might be affected by climate change and the predicted changes to our climate that might be coming to Wisconsin. How wetlands help promote resilience in our earth by providing services like carbon sequestration, which helps us combat some of our climate change-related challenges, and how wetlands help communities be resilient by providing services like floodwater storage and water filtration to help communities address some of those challenges that might increase in a changed climate so that we can be more resilient ourselves.
And Ken, what are you going to be talking about at the conference? I assume it'll relate to this very resilience.
Yeah, that's true. I'll be focusing on, inspiring people to get out and enjoy the wetlands, and also talk about some of our projects in the urban environment where we've actually been recreating and in some cases just creating, straight up creating wetland areas and ephemeral ponds and stormwater catchments and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, Larry, one other reason I wanted Ken to talk at the conference this year is sometimes climate change conversations conversations are a little bit depressing because there's only so much that we can do in our big world. And Ken's work and the work of everybody at his center is so inspiring in terms of identifying and helping cultivate a next generation of leadership that I'm really excited to have that balance of hope for the future.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And Ken, you have three locations around the state? Around the city. I wondered if you were planning to expand to three locations in the Milwaukee area. That's probably keeps you plenty busy enough, but...
Yeah, but it's interesting. We're actually getting calls from cities all over the country and even the world that are looking at the model that we've created using urban environmental education as a way to transform neighborhoods and actually impact an entire city. And for that purpose, we just wrote a book called Urban Ecology, A Natural Way to Transform Kids, Parks, Cities, and the World. It's going to be out in bookstores in April. And will allow us to share our model with places more effectively in other parts of the world.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. maybe as long as we're on it, could you give us kind of a specific example of what you've done in Milwaukee? One example.
Well, sure. We go into challenged urban parks, and we have learned that when you are invited in and you engage the community in park cleanup, and then you start immediately running science-based field trips with the schools right close to the park, that the whole park turns from often a blighted park into a community asset. And there's this upward spiral that occurs where... Remarkably, the education and the kids' performance goes up, the ecological literacy in the community goes up, the volunteerism explodes, and the crime reduction is quite remarkable in the areas that we go, and then slowly the whole community starts to rise. So an urban park is a leverage point for urban renewal, and that's what we've done three times in Milwaukee, and has the potential to replicate elsewhere.
When your book comes out, you'll have to get back and talk about the book some more. That's really very, very cool. And that fits, Katie, that fits right in with what you folks at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association are about.
Absolutely. Yeah, helping connect people with wetlands, helping promote the love of wetlands and all the critters that live in them, and to help promote an understanding of how important they are, not just for wildlife habitat, but for lots of other important things that we value. Like I said earlier, flood protection, clean water, lots of very important services that wetlands provide for us.
Aside from Ken, there are other speakers and other things going on.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Before we go to the phones, take a...
We have two full days of presentations, both oral presentations and poster presentations. We have a student presentation competition, so we're trying to help educate and grow the next generation of wetland scientists. We have a woman who was the past president of the International Society for Wetland Scientists coming to give our keynote address. Her name is Jillian Davies, and she'll be talking... about the theme, you know, how wetlands provide ecosystem services at a greater rate than any other natural system on our landscape, and the significant role they play in the carbon cycle, for example. So sharing her work to illustrate some of these concepts. And then one of our local heroes, John Magnuson from the Center for Limnology here in Madison, he actually was the keynote speaker 10 years ago at our conference, and so we're bringing him back to celebrate at that anniversary, and he'll be giving us an update on what's changed and what stays the same with regards to the health of the waters of Wisconsin.
Taking a look at the resilience of wetlands today with our two guests, Katie Belfus, Outreach Program Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, Ken Leinbach, who is the Executive Director of the Urban Ecology Center. Questions about wetlands, comments about the conference, join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Certainly would love to hear from you. And, well, let's take a call. Sue and Madison up first here. Sue, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
There was an article in Monday's Wisconsin State Journal about high-capacity wells in the state, and it appears that a judge from Dane County tried to limit some of those as they are affecting streams, lakes, and drinking water. And I would like the guests to comment on high-capacity wells and how they affect wetlands. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call, Sue. And actually, last year at our conference, we heard from the fellows at the Wisconsin Geologic and Natural History Survey about work they've done up in the Plover River area looking at groundwater and how it interacts with surface water to try to address some of these issues, because your point is very well taken. There are places, especially in central Wisconsin, where the increase in high-capacity wells is connected to a decrease in surface water in rivers, streams, and lakes, and that's very concerning. Our organization is science-based. We always want to say, let's find the science and apply that science to make the best decision. And so it was great last year to be able to feature that, and the study was very conclusive that they do have, there is an interaction between surface water and groundwater, which makes sense. It's all connected. And that we do need to pay attention to what the impacts are of high-capacity wells, and that there's an importance in terms of not just looking at one well at a time, but looking at the overall cumulative impacts of those wells as we put them in. It's not to say we can't have them, but we need to be smart about how we're doing it.
Yeah. Can I comment from you?
Yeah, I think that every action has an impact, and we just need to be really careful. And there's a certain arrogance, I think, that our species has sometimes in the way in which we value the ecosystem services that supply the air we breathe and the water we drink. And so it's really, I encourage caution with big projects like that.
Yeah. Sue, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Chris in Watertown next. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. There's been a lot of new laws and such regarding Wisconsin's wetlands, I won't go into it. But anyway, how can companies like Foxconn or any company, for that matter, recreate wetlands? It's like if they destroy 2 acres of wetlands, they are required to now recreate an acre of wetland. The wetlands are natural. How can they recreate wetlands which are natural?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question, Chris. Thank you for calling. That's called wetland mitigation, and it's what we like to think of as the last option when you're talking about impacts to wetlands from some development project, whether it's corporate or any other kind of development project. First, we want to avoid affecting the resource. Then we want to minimize any impacts that are inevitable. And the third choice, the last choice, is mitigation. That's creating a wetland or restoring a wetland in a different location from where you are filling in the wetland in order to try to compensate for that loss. Chris is correct that there are some challenges to that because it depends on where you create that new wetland. Is it in the same watershed, or is it in the different part of the state? Is it the same kind of wetland as you're destroying? Is it providing the same services? Those are all questions that don't get well answered in our regulatory system. There is lots of opportunity in Wisconsin for wetland restoration because we have lost half of our wetlands already to things like agricultural conversion and urban and suburban development. And so in places where wetlands have been, for example, tiled and drained to promote agriculture, there is an opportunity to recreate wetlands where they once were on the landscape by removing the drain tile or filling in the ditch or changing, restoring the hydrology that we once altered in order to make that a farmable plot, for example. So wetland restoration is a very important thing. We need to be doing more of it in our state. But wetland mitigation is not the way to get that done. We need to be more strategic about where we're doing that and how we're doing that. And mitigation should always be the last opportunity.
Yeah.
You can create an area where there's water, but it takes many, many, many years to create a wetland because a wetland has a whole chemistry attached to the soils and the water and the plants that live there. It's an ecosystem that's evolved over tens of thousands of years, and so to actually recreate a wetland is a kind of a misnomer. You can create an area with water and you can get the process started, but to actually have it to recreate it, which is what mitigation is about, is a much, much longer process. And so it's, and that often is not understood and ignored or forgotten in the process of mitigation.
Thanks for that point, Ken. That's great.
Excellent. Katie Belfus and Ken Linebach, our guests today, as we talk about Wisconsin wetlands. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Talking wetlands today with Katie Belfus of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Ken Linebach of the Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee. Great to have both of them here as we visit with them about wetlands and about the Wetland Science Conference coming up February 20th through the 22nd in Lake Geneva. And actually, if you go to wisconsinwetlands.org or if you go to urbanecologycenter.org, you're probably going to find out a lot of information.
A lot of more information. And we actually have a specific conference.wisconsinwetlands.org that'll take you directly to the source. There's a link on our main webpage, too. But
and people can still sign up for that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Registration is open for another 2 weeks.
Another couple of weeks yet. Give a call with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Katie, we've talked a couple of issues have come up from callers relating to wetlands. What are some of the most urgent issues the Wetland Association is working on right now?
Well, your listeners might have heard coverage of pending legislation in our state capitol that would have dramatic impact on Wisconsin's wetlands. The federal government has authority, jurisdiction is the fancy word, over some of our state's wetlands, and the state has authority over another group of our state's wetlands. It all has to do with how the wetlands are connected to navigable waters, and I don't need to get into that, but the legislation that's pending would dramatically reduce the protections for wetlands that are in that regulated by the state category. The initial proposal would have removed all regulations from those wetlands. That is, there would be no permit required to fill in an isolated wetland. You'd only have to avoid wetlands that were not isolated or under the federal jurisdiction. There's recent talk in the last couple of days about amendments to that original proposal, and I will say that our organization has continually offered our assistance to those legislators to address the problems that they would like to address through that legislation, because there are some issues with regards to how wetlands are regulated that are very legitimate and that we should find a better solution to get those problems solved. And so far, unfortunately, the work that we have done to try to help improve the legislation has been unsuccessful. And while the publicity in recent days indicates that the bill is better and dramatically reduces the impacts to wetlands, we disagree with that assessment. And there's a number of ways that, in fact, it remains pretty much as bad, because wetland mitigation, which was in the original bill, has been taken off the table. There would be no requirement when people are allowed to fill these wetlands. There would be no requirement for those non-federal wetlands to do wetland mitigation.
Oh.
If people would like more information, I encourage them to visit the Sportsman for Wetlands Facebook page. There's a broad coalition of organizations, including Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, our organization, and a number of other groups who are working together, because we are all in strong agreement that this is not the right way to address the problems that we have with our current system of laws. This is the current proposal does not do that. I'm not the staff person who is doing that work. Our policy staff is hard at work, really 24/7 these days, with that bill. But if anybody's interested, Sportsmen for Wetlands on Facebook is a great place to go to get updates and information about how they can get engaged.
Ken called in with what he thought might be a needed correction about the recreation of wetlands. I think we said that for every acre filled, a company for every 2 acres filled, a company needs to recreate one. But I think it's the for every acre.
And it's different for different, you know, Foxconn. The Foxconn situation has one rule, and you know, I don't want to comment on exactly. I think it is correct that the mitigation requirement is for more acres than the acres that were affected. So that is correct. But it there's not a consistency across the state about what that actual amount is.
Okay. Mike in Kakana, let's go to you next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Just wondering if your group has been able to lobby or get involved with the legislators in our state to, well, prohibiting is probably not possible, but cutting way back on the salt usage on our highways and roads, which obviously pollutes our rivers, lakes, and wetlands. It just makes me sick when I see all the salt that's used.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I know there's at least one presentation at our conference in a couple of weeks that actually is looking exactly at that issue. What is that impact? How can we quantify the amount of salt that gets into wetlands? Because it is dramatic. Sand is the same way. We need safe roads, but that we do need to recognize the impacts. And our organization would love to work with legislators to figure out a solution to this problem or to at least look at it. And there's any number of issues that would help to protect and enrich wetlands. Unfortunately, we're spending all of our time at the legislature battling bad proposals rather than working with legislators to promote good proposals. We are very ready to help promote good ideas and proposals and to work with anybody who's interested in that. But right now, unfortunately, we're in the defensive rather than the offensive.
Mm. Yeah, I know the, when you pull into parking lots at these box stores or anywhere where there's large parking lots, they're actually coated white with all the salt that's applied, and the same with sidewalks. And I understand liability issues, and I understand safety issues for people, but gee whiz, I think more moderation could be in place.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you're going to get any disagreement from Ken or from Katie on that one.
Again, I think we need to go back to science. What is the impact that we're having? How much sand or salt is entering waterways, and what impact is that having on our drinking water quality or the wildlife habitat in those waters, so that we can make decisions that satisfy both concerns, safety and water quality.
Thanks very much for calling, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. So you have a staff of people that work on these kinds of things, Katie, right?
We have about 7 people on our staff, and we cover the entire state of Wisconsin. So several of our staff members are involved in policy work directly. But even those policy staffers do a lot of outreach work to help local communities and policymakers understand the impact that they could have on their beneficial impacts by protecting and restoring wetlands in their communities and helping understand ways that they could incorporate that into their community planning. So our policy folks are working at the legislature and are working on policies, you know, legislative issues, but also doing a lot of other great groundwork to help us.
And I would expect that a legislator in his or her own community and the effects that it might have is probably a way to sort of approach those folks.
Yes, and I think I commend any legislator who genuinely and sincerely wants to learn about the issues, wants to learn what wetlands are, what they do, why they're important, how they're connected. Unfortunately, some of our legislators aren't interested in having that conversation right now. We remain ready to talk to and work with anyone in the legislature about these issues, and we would be happy to do a field tour with legislators who would like to have that conversation.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the phones. Dave in Warrens, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I had a multi-part question for you about cranberry farmers. They use the marshes, and they convert them over to what they want. They also use a lot of groundwater. They're building new marshes all the time, even though they're crying that they have a surplus, and we're subsidizing that with government dollars. And some of the marshes, the water belongs to the state, and some of the marshes, such as Raisin Cranberry Company, don't allow fishermen. They deny access by the way that they sculpt the land around their marshes. What do you think about cranberries?
Well, I think we need to have the same rules for everybody. And my understanding is that cranberry, you are correct, that cranberry farmers have a special set of rules or freedoms, maybe is the better way to put it, that are different from many other agricultural producers in our state regarding water quality and water use. And I don't know the specifics of those rules, but I have heard from a lot of people over the years that there are some challenges that need to be addressed there. So I don't have a solution. Unfortunately, I agree with you, and I wish I had more details to be able to answer that question in a more rich way.
Yeah. Dave, thank you. Cher in Green Bay, let's go to you next. Hi, Cher.
Hello. I just it was in agreement with one of the former callers' comment about the importance of solving the salt usage problem, and I'm wondering if the presenter has any, you know, offers or options on what we can do. I know sand and salt, she mentioned, are both kind of culprits for the watershed problem.
Yeah.
Well, and again, this is not my area of expertise, so I will make a few comments, but won't go into a lot of detail. I think one of the things we need to look at is the rate of application, and are we applying the minimum that we can in order to create the safe conditions that we would like. I know that I trip over piles of salt on sidewalks in our city sometimes because it's put down way too heavily. So people aren't applying it correctly. So that's at a very minimum, if we are going to use these products because we need to be safe, let's make sure we're applying the minimum that's required to reach that safety. So I don't know about other compounds that would be more effective. Unfortunately, that's outside my area of expertise, but I think it'd be a great thing to explore.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, so I mean, I was thinking like the usage on the highways because I travel during my job every day, and but you do think that maybe if we just reduce the amount just used on parking lots and sidewalks, that may have a positive impact?
Given the piles of salt that I have seen, I think there's plenty of opportunity to reduce applications. I don't have statistics on that. It's just personal observation.
Sure, of course.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Ken, you wanted to add there.
Yeah, if I can chime in, one thing that I think that we've discovered is that education across all layers of a process is very important. So often the applicators don't have the education that those who are in charge do, and their job is to keep people from slipping, and they don't know the impact that the salt is having. And one of the things we do at the Urban Ecology Center is, you know, we educate the entire community on issues such as this. And I know that there's some folks at the Water Institute, the UWM Water Institute downtown, that are studying this very thing. And I do know that the impact is large, and reduction can help that process.
Yeah.
Excellent points, Ken. Thank you.
And you take an area like Milwaukee, an urban area with a concentration of people and buildings, you can just imagine the tons of salt, for example, that wind up into what, Lake Michigan probably, or a lot of it.
Yep.
But one other thing I'll add, which is just on a positive note, and Katie, you mentioned this a little bit, but we're always on the defensive, but if we can be on the offensive, and offense in this case means if we as a race, you know, the human race, if we actually partner with the natural systems of the planet, the nature's a really good partner. And we've discovered many times in the work that we do in the city where we're restoring parks and areas along the Menominee River and the Milwaukee River, how quickly things come back when we do the right things. And it's a good lesson for us all that we actually there's a way to make this work. And I think we have the capacity to make that happen. And so I get excited about that.
I was just thinking about an article I read in Sports Illustrated a few years ago about the Chernobyl disaster, and so everybody had to leave that area, and how over the years the land was healing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was surprising a lot of people how quickly things were changing. In other words, Mother Nature was You're right. Mother Nature can kind of be a partner and, is a partner and can really have a very positive impact given some assistance.
Yeah, I love that language. That's great. Let's be a partner with nature.
Yeah. Well, let's take some more calls. Mitch in Green Bay, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. How are you doing, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you today?
I'm interested in ephemeral ponds because they are, they had a couple articles on them, and I was interested in their seasonality, but also how they protect a lot of our amphibians, because the ephemeral pond is a good breeding area for their and a good place for them to bring their eggs and everything along. That if it was in a fish pond, the fish would have a nice meal, but the salamanders and the toads would not have a very good productive breeding season.
Well, Mitch, you've been doing your homework. You're exactly right. Ephemeral ponds are those shallow, temporary ponds that show up in the spring following snowmelt and spring rains. And typically, those areas are dry by late summer, early fall. Sometimes when we have heavy rains in the fall, they fill back up, but oftentimes they're dry. So in many parts of the year, they don't look like wetlands because there's no visible water. But we know, as Mitch pointed out, they're tremendously important, particularly to ducks, trout, fur bears, and northern pike. As he said, you know, if you've got a pond that's big enough to support fish, those fish are going to eat the eggs of the frogs and the salamanders, and so you don't get the reproduction. Whereas in an ephemeral pond where you don't support a fish habitat, you have a great place for those babies to grow. They're also essential for ducks on their way to making eggs, because they eat all the little crustaceans that grow in those waters, and that the calcium in those crustaceans is what helps make the shells on the eggs hard to protect the eggs. And I will point out that the legislation that's pending in our capital right now specifies certain kinds of wetlands that would continue to be affected, and ephemeral ponds are not on that list of protected wetland types. So under the current proposal, my understanding is that ephemeral ponds would be free reign. Go for it. Build whatever you'd like.
Well, and the challenge is that an ephemeral pond, to the untrained eye, sometimes this looks like a puddle. And so it's all about community education,
right,
to get folks to understand the connections and the relationships that our land possesses. We actually one of our projects, most recent projects actually, was the recreation of an ephemeral pond, or the creation of ephemeral pond in one of our urban parks. And it was a exciting project. We're planting it right now, and this, we're anxiously awaiting the spring to see how it performs.
Wow, that's really, how do you go about creating one? It may take too long to describe, but there must have been a lot of work involved in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's partnering with nature, right? And I think technically we're calling it a stormwater catchment and ephemeral pond, but it required bulldozers and a lining of clay, and then planting native plants, and it's already working. As soon as we finished, it started filling with water, and it's got a system to that the water It'll dry on its own, but we also have a system that will allow us to make sure that happens.
Yeah, so that's a great opportunity for education. It might not be a quote-unquote natural ephemeral pond, but he's able to teach about natural ephemeral ponds because he has one in the community where he's doing the work. That's a great.
Great. Mitch, thanks again for calling. And I want to give Maureen and Madison a chance to join in. Maureen, hello to you.
Hi. This is probably a very stupid question, but are there any machines that kind of recapture some of the salt sitting in parking lots? And I know counties and such have large expenditures for salt in years where it's used heavily, or some way for car washes to filter out the salt to capture it and reuse it.
Great question. And unfortunately, I don't have an answer. Ken, do you have an answer?
I don't have an answer either. I think it's a great idea, but
yeah.
I, I, I don't think, I've never seen anything like that.
So there's a great opportunity for an entrepreneur out there to figure that out.
And Maureen and everybody else, Leslie in Amberg called in to say that he's been, he has read of areas using beet juice and beer on roads instead of salt.
Why would you pour beer on
too.
A road?
I did not, I haven't, that's the first time I've ever heard.
I have heard of the beet juice. That is cool.
But beer, that's a new one. But Ken, you've heard of that.
I've heard of it as well, but I don't have any more knowledge.
Okay. Ken, do you guys have some events coming up that you want to tell us about?
Well, sure. If you're in Milwaukee, or even if you're not, this coming weekend at our Menominee Valley branch, which is in the shadow of Miller Park, we're doing a candlelight walk in partnership with a couple other groups, and it's just a chance to get out with the community. Last time we had over 1,000 people show up and go for a hike through Three Bridges Park, which is a park that we built along the Menominee River. It's a 26-acre park that we love for people to enjoy, and it connects to the Mitchell Park domes. So it's
cool.
a great walk. That's probably the most exciting, you know, local event that's coming up.
And for Katie, for you, your big event is coming up the February 20th through the 22nd. Talk again about that.
Yeah, that's our annual Wetland Science Conference. This is our 23rd year of doing it. Mostly it's wetland professionals who attend, but we have a lot of dedicated and loving wetland enthusiasts who just come to learn more about wetlands, whether they're managing those on their own property or they like to spend time in them or they're helping their community manage them. So we invite everybody to come out and learn more. Ken is speaking at our banquet, which is Wednesday evening the 21st, and that's open to the public, and we still have tickets available for that. We'd love to have you come out and hear more from Ken. And anybody who wants to learn more about Wisconsin Wetlands Association, we have our annual membership meeting on the Tuesday evening the 20th, also at the Grand Geneva Resort. So you can come on out, meet our staff, hear about what we've been up to, learn more about our organization, which you can also do at wisconsinwetlands.org. We're a member-sustained organization. We'd love to have you become a member.
And membership, and Ken, I'm sure you must rely a lot and value the people who volunteer for your efforts.
Yeah, we have thousands of volunteers, actually, and you can become a member. I encourage everybody to go to urbanecologycenter.org, and I also encourage people to check out our new book, Urban Ecology, A Natural Way to Transform Kids, Parks, Cities, and the World, and it's on Amazon.
Oh, well, we'll get you back to talk about that as well. Ken, thank you so much. Katie, thank you.
Thank you. It's always fun.
Thank you.
Katie Belfus is the Outreach Programs Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Ken Leinbach, nationally recognized educator, leader in community-based environmental education, currently serves as the Executive Director of the Urban Ecology Center. And we'll talk with them again about wetlands, I am sure. Coming up, we're going to switch to lakes a little bit more. The Lake Winnebago Waterway System holds the largest single concentration of sturgeon in the world. And we'll talk about that and about a great event coming up relating to sturgeon right in that area. Next on the Ideas Network.